It had been successful beyond all our hopes, and it was only the first of many more I was to give, not only in London but in the largest halls all over the country, and I felt more assured than ever that my life was to be devoted to comforting those who mourn and giving certainty to those seeking to know what lies beyond the illusion we call death. After that evening, letters arrived at the Temple of Light by the sackful. So many people wanted to sit with me privately or to join our group seances. So many societies all over England wanted me to demonstrate my mediumship, that it became abundantly clear I would have to severely restrict the amount of work I did, or I would risk a nervous breakdown and perhaps as a consequence lose my precious gift altogether. To this end, the Temple of Light was reorganized, and all matters of Idiaresis, negation, nance, and administration were taken out of my hands by the committee. This was so I would be free from worry and anxiety, and my work could be arranged in such a way that my mediumship would be used to help as many people as possible without overtaxing my strength or my nervous system. Reverend Arthur Sharp resigned from St. Stephen's in Hampstead, to become our president, and Reverend Charles Drayton Thomas joined the committee. I had a wonderful band of friends gathered around me at that time. They were full of enthusiasm. At another demonstration in full light, this time at the Scala Theatre in London, was a voice purporting to be that of the Methodist pioneer John Wesley. He delivered a wonderful oration in which he told the audience of the spirit world's plan to bring light to our darkened world and to spread the truth of life after death. As I sat in my stuffy cabinet on the stage and listened to him, I marveled at his eloquence and mastery of language, so far beyond the limits of my own education. When Wesley's voice faded and after various entities had spoken to friends in the audience, the voice of a young girl was heard. She was excited and apparently overcome with emotion. Her words halting but clear, she said it was her first attempt to communicate. "What is your name?" asked Drayton Thomas, who was sitting on the stage along with Lord Dowding in my home circle. "My name is Doreen," the girl answered. "Can you tell us your other name?" someone asked. And as though the girl found it too difficult to speak, Mickey answered for her, saying that her surname was Marshall. There was a buzz of excitement from the audience as they speculated whether Doreen Marshall could be one of the victims of the perverted killer Neville Heath, who had been hanged for the murder of another unfortunate girl not long before. "Did anyone here know Doreen Marshall?" Drayton Thomas asked the audience. A man somewhere near the front called out, saying that he lived opposite her home. Then the girl tried to speak again. "I am all right now," she said. Then, speaking to the man who had claimed to be a neighbor, she told him, "I used to pat your dog." By that time the girl's emotion was too overwhelming and the link was broken. As I listened to the audience, who were still buzzing with excited comment, I could not help feeling sad that the efforts this poor murdered girl had made to communicate had an effect so much greater than the entire speech made by the voice of John Wesley. After Owen had returned to civilian life, he went back to his old job at Elstree Studios, but as the weeks passed, both Edith and I noticed with concern that he was not the happy-go-lucky young man he had been before the war. He was restless and unsettled, and he had taken to spending his evenings shut away in his room instead of going out with his friends as he used to do. I thought this uncharacteristic behavior was the result of his years of strain as a bomber pilot, and I made allowances for his unaccountable mood swings and Idiaresis, negation, ashes of irritability, which were so unlike his old self. Remembering the concussion after his crash landing, we anxiously kept asking him if he was suffering from headaches, blurred vision, or symptoms of vertigo. He would answer us with exasperated sighs or calmly cast his eyes up towards heaven. Edith began to talk rather glibly about neuroses and the splitting of personalities under stress, and I discovered she was taking psychology textbooks from the local library and hiding them behind cushions in the sitting room if Owen or I were about. The answer to Owen's malaise turned out to be simpler than anything that had occurred to his mother or I. During a period of flight training in California, he had fallen in love with an American girl. They had corresponded throughout the war, and as soon as he was back in civilian life, Owen had written to her proposing marriage. Since he had been completely honest about his financial prospects, which were less than dazzling, and this girl was the daughter of wealthy parents. Owen waited anxiously for her answer, alternating between euphoric help and the blackest despair. As soon as she got in touch to say she was taking the first available boat to England to marry him, Owen was himself again. Owen and Jane were married by Father Sharp in his former Church of St. Stephen's. Jane was a beautiful bride and Owen a very proud bridegroom. What remained of Owen's squadron formed a guard of honor, and since the bride's parents were unable to travel to England for the ceremony, I stood in to give Jane away. It was a happy wedding, but Edith still shed a few tears as the couple left for their honeymoon on the coast. Later they settled into a small diocese legation at Inmidavale, and in due course a daughter was born who gave Edith and the young parents great joy. When the blow fell, it was sudden. We had been out to dinner with friends and it had been a happy evening. On the way home on the train, Edith remarked that she felt rather strange, and when I looked at her under the train lights, her face was grey. I wanted to telephone for the doctor as soon as we got home, but Edith would not allow it, so I gave her some brandy which put the colour back into her face and reassured me. It was dawn when I awoke with a start, feeling uneasy. I looked at Edith and she seemed to be peacefully sleeping. The feeling of unease persisted, and when I looked more closely at her, I saw one corner of her mouth was drooping. I sprang out of bed and ran to the phone. When the doctor came, he told me Edith had suffered a stroke. From the cheery, bright personality she had been, my wife was suddenly helpless and 5 years of illness had begun. One of Edith's married daughters helped me through the first most difficult period, by nursing her mother devotedly, but soon the time came when she and her family had to move to another area, so I had to manage as best I could on my own. Although I am able to talk to those who guide and help me from the other side as easily as my sitters, I do not usually ask for help with material problems. They have always made it very clear that I must not expect my life to be easy, nor must I imagine I am entitled to special privileges because I am their medium. But when the shopping, the cooking, the care of my wife and trying to do my spiritual work at the same time became a burden of almost nightmare proportions, I decided to ask them for help. At the next sitting of my home circle, I asked for someone to be sent to my assistance. "Someone has already been sent," said Mickey. "He's working in this house and he was at your last big meeting at the Kingsway Hall." I could not imagine what Mickey meant. The only person working in the house was a young man hired to redecorate one of the bedrooms. "You can't mean the painter?" I said to Mickey. "Yes, I do," he answered perkily. "His name is Bill Willis and he is wondering what on earth he will do when he finishes the job here because his work partner has walked out on him. Ask him and he will take over your worries and become interested in your work." It was true, there had originally been two painters when the job was started, and for the past few days one of them had been missing, but even so Mickey's solution to my problems seemed highly unlikely. "Ask him. I'm telling you, he'll do it," said Mickey with a trace of impatience at my obvious incredulity. "Very well," I said. "If you say so, Mickey." The next morning, very diffidently, I took a cup of tea into the room where Bill the painter was working. To check on Mickey's statement, I was about to ask him if he had been at my Kingsway Hall meeting when he told me how interesting he had found it. He told me he had sat next to a woman whose son, killed in the war, had spoken to her at the seance. She told Bill that the voice was exactly like the voice of her son when he was on Earth. "Is it really true?" said Bill. "It's almost too wonderful to really be so." I assured him it was true. Then, testing Mickey further, I asked if his partner had left him in the lurch. "Yes," said Bill. "He has left me in a right old mess. I can't carry on the business without someone else and he's walked out for good. I don't know what I'll do when I finish this job. I'll probably end up with a job in a factory. Would you like to come and work here?" I asked. "I need someone to run the house and help me, to care for my wife." Bill hesitated, then asked if a room went with the job. When I said it did, he offered to try it out, so long as I did not mind being experimented upon while he learned to cook. He also said he would like to know more about this spirit business. Soon it became obvious that Bill was a treasure. Quickly he mastered such routine as we had in our house and began to study cookery books and then to serve up delicious and imaginative meals. He became devoted to Edith and fussed over her like a hen with one chick. He also did all he could to make life easier for me, and he soon became a regular sitter in my home circle. In due course, someone he had known and loved on the other side came to speak to him and gave him his personal conviction of survival. Many of my friends and sitters remember Bill with affection. Sadly, a few years later, he suffered a premature death from an inoperable cancer. The Committee of the Temple of Light organized another huge demonstration for me at the Kingsway Hall. As on the former occasion, I was to sit in my stuffy cabinet on the stage while the hall would be fully lighted. Weeks before the advertised date, all available seats were booked, and on the night itself hundreds had to be turned away at the doors and all standing room was taken. As usual, Mickey spoke first, but this time, unusually, he told that huge audience that Mickey was only the name by which he was known in the world of spirit and to his medium. He said that during his earth life he was called John Whitehead and had sold newspapers outside Camden Town Underground Station, until he was run over and killed by a lorry when he was 10 years old. "I'm a lot happier over here than I ever was on your side," he assured the crowded hall. "You could say that kicking the bucket was the best thing I ever did." This caused a general laugh, and the tension throughout the hall reduced noticeably. The next spirit voice claimed to be Jack Hickinbotham, who used to live at 76 Albert Street, Tipton, Staffordshire. From the gallery, a woman's voice answered, "Yes, son, I am here." Mother and son then talked together, across the gulf of death, about such trivialities as the color of a Macintosh, the name of a neighbor's dog, and the nature of the son's last illness. All of these things were of no importance whatsoever in themselves, but to his mother, who had traveled from her home in the Midlands that morning and knew no one in London, they provided convincing evidence that it was to her son she was speaking, although he had been dead for the last 8 years. At the end of the meeting, the Reverend Drayton Thomas gave a short address, in which he tried to impress on the audience that there was more to these demonstrations of ours than the mere fact of communication between this world and the next. "Scientific, domestic and emotional proof were all very well," he said, "but if that were all that was taken away from the meeting, then the orange had been peeled and the fruit thrown away. The real meaning of it all," he went on, "is life moving onwards from level to level and ever reaching up towards God." A few days later, the following letter appeared in Psychic News. A number of the audience at Kingsway Hall attending the Temple of Light direct voice demonstration have wondered if the public address, audio, equipment is quite genuine. Being the engineer responsible for the equipment, I can assure these people that the apparatus is installed on the Saturday morning, several hours before any official from the organization arrives. It is tested by myself, and during the whole of the meeting the microphones are under my sole control. 5 standard velocity type microphones are used. The 2 in front of the cabinet are wired back to the amplifier separately. The 1 used by the chairman and the 1 at the side of the table are unidirectional, that is, will only pick up a signal from the front and are wired in parallel. A ribbon desk-type microphone with a switch is put at the other end of the table and is only alive when the switch is depressed. This is used for asking people in the hall to speak up or to give an explanation during the demonstration. It should be noted that if that switch is used, an immediate automatic indication is given to me. It is quite impossible to use this microphone secretly. The microphones in front of the cabinet are switched on a few minutes after the medium entered the cabinet, and at the same time the table microphones are switched off and are not put on again until the control indicates he has finished. This leaves only the 2 cabinet microphones which can pick up any signal. Frankly, when I first installed this equipment some time ago, I did not expect the microphones to pick up very much, if anything at all, because in between them and the medium is a curtain of fairly thick material, and if the reader would like to try a simple experiment, let him hang a towel over a radio when someone is talking. Of course it goes muffled, and similarly the voice of Mickey should be the same, but as everyone who has heard it knows, it is not so. Now, and this is important, I am not a spiritualist or a personal friend of any of the officials, nor do I know any of the staff at Psychic News, but I would like two questions answered. Is the voice inside or outside the cabinet? If inside, why so clear? Why don't people in the immediate vicinity of the cabinet hear what is going into the microphones? Because in order to get the result that is obtained, it is necessary to speak about 2 feet away from the microphones, in a voice about twice as loud as in normal conversation. It makes you think. The letter was signed by Mr. George A. Muirhead of 99 Drayston Road, London, SW16, who was a sound engineer with the Tannoy Public Address Equipment Company. Bill hesitated, then asked if a room went with the job. When I said it did, he offered to try it out, so long as I did not mind being experimented upon while he learned to cook. He also said he would like to know more about this spirit business. Soon it became obvious that Bill was a treasure. Quickly he mastered such routine as we had in our house and began to study cookery books and then to serve up delicious and imaginative meals. He became devoted to Edith and fussed over her like a hen with one chick. He also did all he could to make life easier for me, and he soon became a regular sitter in my home circle. In due course, someone he had known and loved on the other side came to speak to him and gave him his personal conviction of survival. Many of my friends and sitters remember Bill with affection. Sadly, a few years later, he suffered a premature death from an inoperable cancer. The committee of the Temple of Light organized another huge demonstration for me at the Kingsway Hall. As on the former occasion, I was to sit in my stuffy cabinet on the stage while the hall would be fully lighted. Weeks before the advertised date, all available seats were booked, and on the night itself hundreds had to be turned away at the doors and all standing room was taken. As usual, Mickey spoke first, but this time, unusually, he told the huge audience that Mickey was only the name by which he was known in the world of spirit and to his medium. He said that during his earth life he was called John Whitehead and had sold newspapers outside Camden Town Underground Station, until he was run over and killed by a lorry when he was 10 years old. "I'm a lot happier over here than I ever was on your side," he assured the crowded hall. "You could say that kicking the bucket was the best thing I ever did." This caused a general laugh and the tension throughout the hall reduced noticeably. The next spirit voice claimed to be Jack Hickinbotham, who used to live at 76 Albert Street, Tipton, Staffordshire. From the gallery a woman's voice answered, "Yes, son, I am here." Mother and son then talked together, across the gulf of death, about such trivialities as the color of a Macintosh, the name of a neighbor's dog, and the nature of the son's last illness. All of these things were of no importance whatsoever in themselves, but to his mother, who had traveled from her home in the Midlands that morning and knew no one in London, they provided convincing evidence that it was to her son she was speaking, although he had been dead for the last 8 years. At the end of the meeting, the Reverend Drayton Thomas gave a short address, in which he tried to impress on the audience that there was more to these demonstrations of ours than the mere fact of communication between this world and the next. "Scientific, domestic and emotional proof were all very well," he said, "but if that were all that was taken away from the meeting, then the orange had been peeled and the fruit thrown away. The real meaning of it all," he went on, "is life moving onwards from level to level and ever reaching up towards God." A few days later the following letter appeared in Psychic News. A number of the audience at Kingsway Hall attending the Temple of Light direct voice demonstration have wondered if the public address, audio, equipment is quite genuine. Being the engineer responsible for the equipment, I can assure these people that the apparatus is installed on the Saturday morning, several hours before any official from the organization arrives. It is tested by myself, and during the whole of the meeting the microphones are under my sole control. 5 standard velocity type microphones are used. The 2 in front of the cabinet are wired back to the amplifier separately. The one used by the chairman and the one at the side of the table are unidirectional, that is, will only pick up a signal from the front and are wired in parallel. A ribbon desk type microphone with a switch is put at the other end of the table and is only alive when the switch is depressed. This is used for asking people in the hall to speak up or to give an explanation during the demonstration. It should be noted that if that switch is used, an immediate automatic indication is given to me. It is quite impossible to use this microphone secretly. The microphones in front of the cabinet are switched on a few minutes after the medium entered the cabinet, and at the same time the table microphones are switched off and are not put on again until the control indicates he has finished. This leaves only the two cabinet microphones which can pick up any signal. Frankly, when I first installed this equipment some time ago, I did not expect the microphones to pick up very much, if anything at all, because in between them and the medium is a curtain of fairly thick material, and if the reader would like to try a simple experiment, let him hang a towel over a radio when someone is talking. Of course it goes muffled, and similarly the voice of Mickey should be the same, but as everyone who has heard it knows, it is not so. Now, and this is important, I am not a spiritualist or a personal friend of any of the officials, nor do I know any of the staff at Psychic News, but I would like two questions answered. Is the voice inside or outside the cabinet? If inside, why so clear? Why don't people in the immediate vicinity of the cabinet hear what is going into the microphones? Because in order to get the result that is obtained, it is necessary to speak about 2 feet away from the microphones, in a voice about twice as loud as in normal conversation. It makes you think. The letter was signed by Mr. George A. Muirhead of 99 Drested Road, London, SW16, who was a sound engineer with the Tannoy Public Address Equipment Company. Picture text, above, a public demonstration, with members of Leslie's Home Circle on a platform facing the cabinet. Kingsway Hall, 1946. Next page, a full house for another demonstration at Kingsway Hall. Still currently reading, Voices in the Dark, My Life as a Medium. While the Reverend Charles Drayton Thomas served on the committee of the Temple of Light and was a member of my own home circle, he wore quite a different hat as a member of the Council of the Society for Psychical Research. This society was founded in 1882 by a group of scholars and scientists whose purpose was to make a systematic investigation of certain phenomena which appear inexplicable on any generally recognized hypothesis, and as a body the SPR is generally considered to be the most skeptical in the world. However, once Drayton Thomas had been convinced by various stringent tests of his own that the phenomena produced by my mediumship were not only genuine, but of a high order, he had the courage of his conviction and appeared on the platform at many of my demonstrations to testify publicly to the reality of the voices. It came to Dre's ears that some of his colleagues in the SPR who had attended one of my demonstrations were suggesting the voices were produced by my lips and that I might be obtaining the messages clairaudiently. Dre was determined to devise a test which, if successful, would dispose of this suggestion once and for all. Naturally, I agreed to whatever test conditions he laid down, as I have always agreed to cooperate when I felt a researcher was honest, sincere and open-minded. As to the outcome of Drayton Thomas' experimental test, I cannot do better than to quote from the account of it which he had published in the Psychic News on February 14, 1948. On February 5, I placed over his tightly closed lips a strip of elastoplast. It was 5.5 inches long and 2.5 inches wide and very strongly adhesive. This I pressed firmly over and into the crevices of the closed lips. A scarf was then tied tightly over this and the medium's hands tied firmly to the arms of his chair. Another cord was so tied that he would be unable to bend down his head. Thus, supposing he endeavored during trance to loosen the bandage, it would be quite impossible for him to reach it. Anyone can discover by tightly closing the lips and trying to speak how muffled and unintelligible are the sounds then produced. My experiment was designed to show that under the above conditions clearly enunciated speech and plenty of it could be produced by the direct voice. The experiment was entirely successful. Voices were soon speaking with their usual clarity, and Mickey emphasized his ability several times by shouting loudly. Some 12 persons were present and we all heard more than enough to convince the most obdurate skeptic that the sealing of Mr. Flint's mouth in no way prevented unseen speakers from saying anything they wished. At the close of the sitting I examined the cords and the plaster, finding all intact and undisturbed. The plaster was so strongly adhering I had considerable difficulty in removing it without causing pain. Not long after this account appeared in print I gave a demonstration at Kingsway Hall and afterwards Drayton Thomas described this test and its successful outcome to the 2,000 people in the audience. Dray was very anxious to repeat his test in the presence of the research officer of the SPR who at that time was Dr. D.J. West. I agreed to cooperate and so on May 7, 1948 Dray brought Drive West and three other guests to my seance room at Sydney Grove. After Dr. West and Mr. Dennis Parsons, an SPR colleague of his, had examined the cabinet to make certain no microphone or other apparatus was concealed in it, I took my place inside sitting on an ordinary upright chair. Dr. West and Mr. Parsons then strapped my extended arms to the side posts of my chair, then bound each arm to the chair by winding a long thread of embroidery silk round and round. They then put adhesive plaster across my lips, two strips overlapping horizontally, held in place by crisscross strips vertically and marked the position of the plasters by tracing around them with indelible pencil. The cabinet was then closed and the light in the seance room was left on. This is from a shorthand transcript that was taken of what followed. The Reverend Drayton Thomas gave the invocation. There was a little music and within a few minutes a voice said, "Good evening." This voice was very loud and clear and Drayton Thomas replied, "Very glad to hear your voice." Another voice, "Hello, can you hear?" A sitter, "Yes, we can hear you quite well." Mickey, "Hello, Dre." Drayton Thomas, "Hello, Mickey. Delighted to hear you, especially under these difficult conditions." A sitter, "Is Leslie all right? Is he comfortable, Mickey?" No reply. Voice, "Hello, can you hear me?" A sitter, "Yes, we can hear you, friend. Quite well." Mr. Flint's breathing becomes very heavy. Voice, "Yes, I think so. Wonder if they would like to have break." Mickey, "Hello, how are you?" Dre, "How are you? Cheered by hearing you." Mickey, "Try and see how loud you can shout in these difficult conditions." Voice, "All in good time." There were two voices in discussion, talking quite quietly. Not every word was clear enough to be heard, but one voice said, "Yes, we must do that. Yes, I know, we will do that. He is all right now." A sitter, "We cannot hear so well, can you speak a little louder?" Voice, "There is a certain tenseness there. We have to make allowances. Would you like to have a look at the medium?" Drayton Thomas, "You know we have full light here?" Voice, "Just to satisfy yourselves." Dr. West, "Do you mean we may look at the medium now?" "We are ready to raise the curtain if you are ready for us." "We are willing to look now if you say so." Voice, "Go ahead." Dr. West then raised the curtain. Mr. Flint was in his chair in a trance, with straps and adhesive tape intact. Dr. West made a close inspection and then closed the curtain. This was at 8:15 p.m. Voice, "Quite all right?" Dr. West, "Thank you, friend." Drayton Thomas, "You seem to have him in very deep trance." Voice, "Very necessary for such an experiment." Drayton Thomas, "Willis. Music, please, break." Voice, "Don't be impatient, Mr. Drayton Thomas." Drayton Thomas, "I suppose I am impatient just now, but for this I have really a lot of patience and staying power." Voice, "How long have you been in this now?" Drayton Thomas, 30 years. Voice, "How is your wife?" Drayton Thomas, "Thank you, she is very well, better than she has been for a very long time." Voice, "I am very glad. I want you to realize we are working here under great difficulties." Drayton Thomas, "That is obvious, but we are getting so many voices." Mickey, "What about me? I'm here, you know." Drayton Thomas, "Yes, Mickey, we are very glad to hear you so clearly." Voice, very loud and clear. God bless you all. This is White Wing. I am very pleased to be here. I want you to realize we are working under difficulties, but we are very happy to be here with you. A sitter, thank you very much. We are very glad to hear you. White Wing, you know, Mr. Willis, your cabinet is not dark, no. The light comes in through the top, not through the vent, through the curtain. It makes it more difficult. Never mind, we are very anxious to help you and cooperate with you all. Dr. West, we are very pleased to hear that.